In the beginning of John's Gospel, that place, that beautiful introduction that starts with the familiar words, that in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. A little bit further down from that, but in that first chapter, we read, "No one has ever seen the face of God. It is the only Son who is close to the Father's heart, who has made him known." Now I offer this other reading from the New Testament because the first reading that I had there is from Revelation. And Revelation is, well, I come here today after watching the Tour de France for the last 3 weeks. I watched the Tour de France religiously every year for the past 30 years. I am, as a matter of fact, a member of the Société de la Tour de France, having been the technical director on their first attempt at a professional road race in the United States, and this was half a lifetime ago. In the Tour, things are sorted out, basically, in the mountains, in the Alps, and in the Pyrenees. And to give a glimpse of what is coming up, they classify the different climbs from a fourth category climb, which is, it's more than just a rolling hill as you're out on the road. They're saying, yeah, there is this thing, you might want to think about it a little tiny bit. And moving on up through third category and second category and first category, where they're saying, you better plan on this because this will be the day. But then after that, they have what they call HC, hors classement, beyond classification. This is sort of cycling's way of saying they turn the volume up to 11, if you know what I mean. And Revelation, I would suggest, is hors classement. It is not a story of the Lord in his ministry in this earth, nor of the early days of his church, of this church. It is a vision of what is to come, a vision of the New Jerusalem. No one has ever seen the face of God, says John, but knowing that the Word became flesh, there has been an awful lot of speculation about what the incarnate Word might have looked like. For me, this picture by Warner Solomon, this is the Jesus that I grew up with. This is, in my mind, the official picture of Jesus, the one that I would imagine we would see on his passport. Facebook page, yeah. This is the one. But of course, through the years there have been many, many other attempts at this same thing. This is a 16th century painting by Antonio de Correggio. I rather like this one. It shows a very compassionate, a very caring man. There are somewhat Semitic features involved there, and I applaud the artist for his honesty there. Of course, there's one of the problems in this. Everybody reads into these interpretations, into these portraits, their own Jesus. If we look at the paintings of Wei Che, his is a very Chinese Jesus. The portrayals in the Coptic Church show a very Ethiopian Jesus. A few years ago, there was a fairly interesting little film called Jesus 2000, which in seminary school, we got a number of good laughs out of it for having the surfer dude Jesus. A few years ago, the National Catholic Reporter, their magazine, National Magazine, sponsored a contest for a new image of Jesus. They came up with this. I rather fancy this. This is by Janet McKenzie. It's known as Jesus of the People. It's a good snapshot of faith in this time in the world's history. I wish I had a better copy of this. You're invited to come and look at all these afterwards. And Jeff, this is how I got around not having a PowerPoint presentation to do this.
I love the technology.
Go with what works. And then perhaps this, the Shroud of Turin. A lot of controversy around this. I honestly don't know what to think of the Shroud of Turin, but I keep this portrait on my wall. If it is concocted by people, it's an inspired concoction. This is not the face I think we would normally consider. I guess Turin can go over here. Now, there's nothing wrong with this kind of speculative exercise. Allowing ourselves purely through imagination to envision the incarnate Lord, the Word made flesh. It lies within the very purpose of the Lord taking on his human element to inspire our imagination while urging us to be born anew in the Spirit. The Lord acknowledges that what is born of the flesh is flesh. And so our natural minds need something that they can attach themselves to. In the writings that form the basis of our particular denomination, Emanuel Swedenborg concedes that throughout the heavens, one finds no other idea of God than the idea of a person. The infinite, he says, surpasses all understanding. When we try to think of God as only spirit, we begin to picture a somewhat amorphous cloud. And he writes, the thought which is not directed to some particular form is diffused in all directions. And what is thus diffused is dissipated. Ultimately, he cautioned us that this leads to falling away from any idea of God at all, and consequently from the idea of faith and of all things of heaven and the church. We are left then to worship only nature in its minutest parts, Swedenborg says, by which he means to worship our own cleverness of mind. That becomes our God. And so we need this mysterious force of the Word made flesh. No one can believe in and love a God whom he cannot comprehend under some form, Swedenborg writes in the Arcana. Now, about at the same time that our New Testament began to take form, at about the same time as those events, the Bhagavad Gita appeared in India. In the Gita, God is manifested in the form of Lord Krishna. And Krishna says this, although I am unborn, deathless, the infinite Lord of all things, through my own wondrous power, I come into finite form. Wherever righteousness falters and chaos threatens to prevail, I take on a human body and manifest myself on earth in order to protect the good, to destroy the doers of evil, to ensure the triumph of righteousness. In every age, I am born. Now, Krishna is described as having blue skin and four arms, and somehow that does not comport well with the way our largely Eurocentric imaginations work. But we tend to overlook the fact that we have within our own text a very vivid description of the Divine One, or more accurately, of one like the Son of Man. And I read this earlier. He stands in a long robe with a golden sash, has hair white as snow, has eyes like fire, feet like bronze, a voice like many waters, a sharp two-edged sword coming from his mouth, his face shining like the sun. And yes, I admit that at first blush, this is not much less fanciful than blue skin and too many limbs, but I beseech you not to turn away from this description so quickly. We are given this gift in the Word. We are given an image of God to contemplate whenever we need it. An image that when we consider the clues that we find in these rather incredible details can lead our natural minds to unlock higher spiritual truths. This one, like the Son of Man, has, for instance, hair white as wool, white as snow. And we know that Proverbs says that gray hair is a crown of glory gained in a righteous life. Look at how many righteous people we have here today. I must tell this story on myself. A few years ago, I had to reapply for my passport. So I took the application home and filled it out and left it there on the dining room table and went about doing other things. And I heard this laughter coming from in the dining room. And I go in and my two daughters and my wife are in stitches. And I say, "What's so funny?" And they say, "Daddy, what color is your hair?" And I say, "Well, my hair is brown." "Oh, Daddy, you're so funny." But I digress. The image in Revelation has white hair, not gray hair. It is white as wool. It is white as snow. It is absolutely immaculately perfectly pure, and this in a temple religion where purity is absolutely their fixation, and that is the God that is described here, pure. In other traditions, especially in polytheistic ones, other qualities creep into the pantheon of deities. There's Dionysus and the Cupids in Greek mythology. There's Loki amongst the Norse gods. In Native American tradition, there is frequently Coyote, you know, the Joker, the trickster. We have our own biblical myths of how we are kept humble, but this has nothing to do with how God is depicted here. Absolutely pure. You can depend on this God. You can put all your faith there. His eyes burn like fire. We know that most of the time when we find heat and fire spoken of in the Word, that it represents divine love. His eyes burn like fire. People who have had near-death experiences quite often find themselves standing before a figure that they somehow know is the Divine One. And they frequently report experiencing a review of their own lives as they stand there, when they recall everything in infinite detail, much greater than they experienced it as they lived it, and they often view it and see it from different perspectives. They see how their acts have affected other people. And with this brutal and this frightening honesty, they see what has motivated most of their actions, and they're appalled to discover what louses they have been. All the while, the figure standing there before them going, "Yeah, I knew that. Yeah, I've always known that about you. I love you. I always have loved you. I always will love you. Now, what are you going to do?" In the Gospels, the Lord tells us that every tree that does not bear good fruit shall be cut down and thrown into the fire. And in many Christian churches, this is taken quite literally as a glaring threat and a dire warning. We here, on the other hand, understand that we cannot be coerced in matters of faith, not even by, especially not by, the Lord, as that would interfere with our free will, which is part of what makes us human. But if and when we see that fire is love, we realize the Lord is telling us, if you will let me in, I will cut down every roadblock, every obstacle that impedes your uniting with me. All your fears, all your jealousies, all your compulsions to gain power and to control others, I will burn these away with my love, out of love for you, my child. This one, like the Son of Man, wears a golden sash. He has put on the highest raiments. He has clothed himself with the noblest teachings. The Apostle Paul tells us that we must put on imperishability, that we must put on immortality. Is this what we don when we tell ourselves, well, if it wasn't for bad luck, I wouldn't have no luck at all? Do we win the gold when we declare that life is hard and then you die? Our church in Puget Sound for a while wore t-shirts that read, "Life is wonderful and then you live forever." A sharp, double-edged sword comes from the mouth of this one. And so often we have learned that images of swords and knives in the Word represent the truth. The sword will cut through all the lies, all the deceptions, all the rationalizations, all the excuses that we make for not living the way that our God intends for us. This one, like the Son of Man, will cut through to the truth that shall make us free. So this is an image that I invite us all to hold whenever we ponder God, whether in worship and adoration, or, and perhaps most especially, when life's challenges make us wonder about and even doubt our God, our rock. Many times we find that the trials and the tribulations of this life actually help bring us to shed an earlier and a less mature understanding of God for one that brings us to even deeper union. God, the God who is pure, who is love and truth, who is the highest aspirations realized. God is steadfast. But we change. I don't think I know anybody who doesn't need to change. And speaking of changes and images of the Lord, the Revelation passage also speaks of seven lampstands and seven stars in the Lord's right hand. If we were to read further today, which we shall not, we would see that these are the angels and the churches of the seven Christian congregations in Asia Minor, and each one of them will be addressed and described in detail one by one. I know that this church here has gone through a long process of reflection, of honest self-recognition and redefinition, and you're not quite yet where you had hoped you would be by now. I would advise you to stay to this vision of the God of love and truth of purity and of highest calling, remembering that Swedenborg said that that is called the church where the Lord is acknowledged and where the Word is. For the essentials of the church are love to the Lord from the Lord and faith in the Lord from the Lord. And the Word teaches us how we must live in order that we may receive love and faith from the Lord. Now, I was in the garden here the other day, and I noticed that on that redwood tree that stands near the parish house, each shoot was displaying bright green needles where new foliage was coming in. And I took this to be an extremely good omen for the future of this church. As our reading from Psalm 1 said, "They are like trees planted by streams of water, the righteous are, which yield their fruit in its season, and their leaves do not wither." I saw these bright green shoots on the tree, and I knew the Lord was saying, "Behold, I am making all things new." God's blessing be upon each and every one of you, and upon the San Francisco Society.